Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll explore a number of subjects in the news, and we'll be exploring the ramifications of a complete collapse of our efforts in Iraq, beginning with Bob Baer, who was a case officer in the Director of Operations for the Central Intelligence Agency from 1976 to 1997. He's the author of Sleeping with the Devil and See No Evil, both of which are used as the basis of the film Syriana, which is out now and it's up for a couple of Academy Awards. Bob Baer, he's one of the few people in the government that speaks Arabic, that knows the region, particularly Iraq. He was after the first Gulf War, he was sent to the north of Iraq, to the Kurdish north, to organize the Iraqi opposition. People like Chalabi and Dalawi, these people he knows well, of course, thinks are a bunch of thieves and imposters. But that's the people that the Bush administration chose to bring democracy to the Middle East. This whole thing is blowing up in our face. So we'll be talking in a moment with Bob, who believes that it's perhaps the possibility of a cutoff of oil, that it will be spread into a wider regional war. And we already have a civil war, which is now breaking out into the open. Then we'll talk about Islam trying to avoid a clash of civilizations, a new crusade. It seems to be stumbling towards that out there, and we're quite ignorant about this religion, and we'll be shedding some light on Islam and how to avoid a clash of civilizations and religious wars with Dr. Khalid Abu Al-Fadl. His book, The Great Theft, Wrestling Islam from the Extremists, we'll be talking about that. As I say, this is an extraordinary moment in the political history of this country. We're poised on the cusp of a vast foreign policy disaster. It probably will bring about the end of the Bush regime, but the country will pay dearly for it. Let's now go to the subject of the Middle East with one of the few people who knows the Middle East, who speaks Arabic, who spent a lot of time in Iraq, and who warned about this disastrous war before it happened, as did we here on this program, Background Briefing, before the war, predicting it would be a quick victory followed by a slow defeat. We obviously got that a little bit wrong. It's a quick victory followed by a quick defeat. Let's now go to Bob Baer. I'm speaking with Robert Baer, who was a case officer in the Director of Operations for the Central Intelligence Agency from 1976 to 1987. His overseas assignments included stints in various locations in the Middle East and elsewhere, handling agents that infiltrated a number of groups within the region, including Hezbollah, Libyan intelligence, and Al-Qaeda. He is the author of Sleeping with the Devil, How Washington Sold Our Soul for Saudi Crude, and See No Evil, both of which were used as the basis for the film Syriana, which is up for an Academy Award, or a number of Academy Awards, isn't it, Bob?
Two, I think.
Two. And obviously, and you were also working on your first work of fiction, Blow the House Down, which will be coming out this summer. Obviously, this is an extraordinary moment now for U.S. foreign policy. Do you think in an historical sweep, we might be looking at the equivalent of who lost China, who lost Vietnam? In other words, who lost the Middle East?
I think we're on the threshold of losing the whole place. We've lost large parts of Pakistan, have fallen out from under control of the Pakistani government. Saudi Arabia remains on the brink. Iraq, we're going to lose the war. The question is, when do we acknowledge it? When do we pull out? And the third question is, when is this going to spread and how far is it going to spread, the chaos from Iraq throughout the Middle East? And that's impossible to predict, precisely at least.
If this civil war, which is, there's been an incipient civil war in Iraq for some time, but if it blows up into a full-scale civil war, I can't see any alternative but for the United States to not so much withdraw, but retreat, perhaps retreat under fire. So, and furthermore, if there is the civil war in Iraq, a full-blown one, how, I can't see any way that that won't become a regional war, because to some extent it's already a surrogate war with the Iranians behind the Shia and the Saudis and Jordanians behind the Sunni.
I think you're right. There is a civil war going on in Iraq. It fits the definition of a civil war, the number of people dying, the divisions, the implacable differences. It fits our traditional definition of a civil war. The Saudis right now are sending people and money to support the Sunni. You know, think what you will about the Saudi royal family, but politically they have no choice to let this happen. The Syrians are part of this civil war as well. They've been drawn into it. Even if they wanted to, they couldn't back out. There are too many Iraqi refugees. And you, once you pull the Syrians in, you've pulled the Lebanese in with the same Shia-Sunni divisions. Now, the question is, you know, as a former CIA officer, I have to take the worst-case scenario, and that this conflict's going to move down into the Gulf. You know, five Arab states control 50 to 60% of the world's oil reserves. What do we do at that point when those oil reserves are threatened? We saw what happened in Upcake a couple days ago. We saw what happened in Upcake yesterday. That's going to get worse as well. I think as Americans, we have to acknowledge that we cannot dispense of the oil in the Gulf. We are going to have to secure that oil some way, whether it means seizing the oil fields, cutting a deal with a successor regime in Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states. I don't care what it is. We just simply can't dispense with it. And that's really the future we're looking at, saving Iraq, Syria, Egypt, the Palestinians. We've lost that battle.
But let's just focus on the oil, since that's the prize. That area, the Gulf states and Saudi and Kuwait, Sunni regimes, but with the Shia majority population in the areas where the oil fields are. Bahrain, for example, there's been some unrest there as well. How could you ever secure that area if we're at war with the Shia? Because it seems to me throughout this whole exercise, you can't help feel the hand of the Iranians here. Our side's been, you know, taunting them and talking about invasion. Israel's apparently got some plans. I mean, I can't help feel that Ahmadinejad is poking us in the eye here.
Oh, absolutely. There are two aspects to Iranian policy. One is that they know they've won in Iraq. They presently occupy the major fields in the south. Majnoon, in particular, is the big field. The Shia population has no choice but to go with the Iranians. Most of the fuel that supports the south, refined fuel, is coming out of Iran. There are Iranian surrogates controlling most of the cities in the south and southern Iraq. There are Iranian forces actually inside Iraq. They're in the police stations in Basra. We just haven't acknowledged that point. By the way,
Bob, does that mean that the British, the 8,000 Brits in Basra, are essentially under siege?
They've pulled back. They've pulled into garrison.
They have.
The whole mission right now is to minimize their losses.
Right. Do they have an exit?
They don't have an exit strategy. They're going to leave with us, the United States, when we leave.
And what do you think our exit strategy is? If it's a strategy or it's just a... Is it going to be like Saigon in April of 75?
There is no exit strategy, and it's going to be like Vietnam, except worse. Because remember, in Vietnam in 1975, we could control the streets of Saigon right up till the end, and so could the South Vietnamese army. Now we can't even control the streets of Baghdad. We can't go out. We can't get our journalists back. They've been kidnapped. The infrastructure is falling apart at an increasing degree, and we're alienating the Iraqis, unlike we ever alienated the Vietnamese.
So why is it then that this situation is so much worse than the government appears to understand and that the press reports? I mean, the analogies with Vietnam are appropriate here. You know, Saigon compared to Baghdad is an open city. Only the suicidal leave the green zone. So it's been this way for a while. Why this sort of collective delusion on our part?
I think it's a collective delusion within the walls of the White House and with the neocons that can't believe that they'd gotten it so wrong, that are in, I hate to use the word, they're in denial that this is happening. And they're trying to paint it in the best light they can. But I think the real revolt now, and as much as you can tell, it's within the Pentagon. It's the generals that have lost confidence in the White House, because the generals know we can't go into a conflict with Iran right now because our 140,000 troops in Iraq would be hostages. We don't have reserves to call on to send them into the Middle East to defend that army. And they're worried about the White House. You know, this is a small anecdote, but when we showed the premiere of Sirian in Washington, the woman that hosted a party was General Casey's wife, and her husband's commander in Iraq. And this is a very anti-administration movie. There's no way to describe it. But and she and other people I've met in Washington are really worried about where this is going. They're starting to panic, in fact.
You know, you speak Arabic. You were there running the operations with the Iraqi opposition after the first Gulf War. And we spoke before about this, and you know, here in a humble little public radio station in Los Angeles. I mean, I got the picture right, and the government didn't. I talked to people before this war that said it would be a complete catastrophe. You said that nobody even wanted to talk to you. Nobody asked for your counsel. The few people, the handful of people like yourself, inside this government with experience that knew Iraq, were never consulted. I mean, is it that clear?
It was that clear. Well, I mean, it was, you know, the State Department got it. The Arabists at the State Department, whether the Arabists are pro-Arab or pro-Israeli, and frankly, most of them are pro-Israeli, got it. They understood you couldn't go into Iraq, which is probably the most bloody-minded country in history in the Middle East ever. It's the way that the Arabs describe it. You couldn't go in there and put a foreign army on the ground and not expect a horribly xenophobic reaction. But the problem is that you look at the neocons, there's not a single one of them that have spent any time in the Middle East. The one neocon that they relied on that has any credentials at all was Bernard Lewis from Princeton, but he's a Turkish specialist, and Turks are not Arabs. Then you've got the New York Times, people that clearly took sides and were not looking objectively, Tom Friedman. And Tom Friedman has had an enormous influence on Americans, the way they look at this war, that democracy would change things in this part of the world, that liberating Iraq would liberate the rest of the Middle East, which was just pure folly, of course.
Well, the neocons in this administration wouldn't have the influence. They've been around for a long time. They had some traction during Reagan. Bush Sr. had nothing to do with them. Clinton had nothing to do with them. Then they came back with Bush Jr. with a vengeance. But the enablers for the neocons are clearly Rumsfeld and Cheney. So what's their motive? I mean, are they just in denial? Why did they follow the counsel of these kind of amateur, reckless foreign policy romantics?
Well, the problem, I think, and I don't know either one of them, is they were cold warriors. And they came in with a simple message into Bush, who didn't understand the world at all, is, look, we won the Cold War. We brought down the Berlin Wall. We outspent these guys. We brought democracy. We won. We can do the same thing in the Middle East. Rumsfeld, when I was assigned to Syria, would come through, and he never understood it back then. But he just thought at that point that the State Department was weak, as well as the CIA. Cheney hated the CIA, and Cheney hates the State Department. And they just completely dismissed, well, I guess for a better word, the Arabists and the CIA and the State Department. So these guys got it consistently wrong. They're weak on Islamic fundamentalism. They're weak on terrorism. They're appeasers. We're going to show a little bit of strength in the Middle East, and it's going to be over very quickly.
Well, why is it then that I mean, obviously there's a strategic failure here, a gaping strategic failure. They're just not looking at the strategic implications and not having any strategic vision. In fact, Paul Pillar, the guy that just quit, the chief analyst from the CIA, pointed this out, that this administration were bent on selling this war. They never thought beyond the war itself and the implications for inserting or for breaking Iraq. The press have obviously been derelict since the true picture of how bad it is still hasn't penetrated the consciousness of the country. But on top of this, the failure of the opposition in this country in terms of a democracy is so glaring because, as far as I can tell, the Democrats have never had any kind of narrative, an alternative narrative, in the face of this manifest disaster. I mean, in other words, Bush's mistake has become the Democrats' problem. So
the Democrats don't even have any sort of caucus on the Middle East to put together a policy. They are still running this election on the Clinton agenda from the 90s of improving the economy, doing health care and the rest of it. They're not aware of how deeply in trouble we are. They have a sentiment of it, and if they're not aware of the problem, there's not much they can do to fix it.
But this could be their equivalent of who lost China, couldn't it? In the way that the Republicans were able to capture foreign policy, which they've basically owned since the 50s.
They're still gun-shy after 9/11. They're afraid of being labeled as betrayers of national security, and I think that's what they're worried about. If they take Bush on when American soldiers in the field, they think that they're going to pay the price in 2006, this election.
But this will be the biggest disaster imaginable. I mean, how could it not be Bush's war? And I mean, I know what Bush is going to do, at least I think I know, and that is he's going to say, look, we did the best we could. We tried to bring them democracy. They don't want it. You know, it's on them, not on us. You know, we gave the college try. And then the American people will be relieved if we get out of there at any rate.
Oh, I think they're going to be relieved. They want out, but they don't know the way out either.
I see. So it's...
And there's another question that we have to, you know, really deal with is no one's paying the price. This is not a volunteer army. It's, you know, grosso modo, it's made up of poor whites, blacks, Hispanics, and you know, people that are very patriotic are out there fighting. But it's not the average American who's paying the price. And right now, you could pretty well say that the Japanese and the Chinese are loaning us the money to fight this war. We're not paying a price. And it's not bringing the war home like it in World War II.
Mm. But it will bring it home if the chips fall the way that you were talking about earlier, Robert Baer, where it's inevitable that there'll be a wider regional clash as Iraq collapses in civil war.
Well, how about let's go back to Upcake. If they had used an airplane instead of car bombs, which didn't make it in, and they'd run into the middle of that facility with an airplane, we'd be hitting $200. You know, a barrel for gasoline, we'd be paying $8-$9 for a gallon of gasoline. That will hit home, that there really is a crisis. And, you know, after Opcake, we're not that far away.
Well, that's what I wonder about the level of nihilism here in this situation. It seems that if it really does spin out of control and become a regional war, and that you know, as you mentioned, a minor terrorist act can shut down the Saudi oil fields, that's not to say the Iranians will be shut down. And it seems to me that we could have a situation where they will continue to be the winners.
You know, that could be an optimistic situation, an outcome. What if the Iranians simply took the oil fields and they returned to the position that the Shah held as the protector of the Gulf?
Well, there is.
That's far-fetched, but it's possible.
Right. Well, what do you think that we were talking earlier about? It seems to me that we picked a fight with this Iranian radical who's running the country now. And he's obviously got a domestic agenda to cause friction, which makes him popular. They did make a deal today with the Russians. They always had that deal with the Russians over the nuclear fuel cycle. So, to some extent, I never understood the theatrics of that. I think it was playing domestically in Iran. It was popular card to play, the nuclear card. But the long and the short of it, doesn't seem to be such an issue anymore. So what do you think this guy is up to?
Well, there's a problem. Is Ahmadinejad is a wild card in that he's a Shia Twelver, and he believes in the apocalypse. Secondly, he's got American blood on his hands. He's killed Americans. He was involved in TWA-847, a hijacking in 1985. He personally oversaw the assassination of three Kurds in Vienna, and I could go on and on and on. I think he's a believer. If he were a pragmatist, I'd be hopeful that he could come to some arrangement with the United States. I think he's intent upon building a nuclear weapon. I think he's intent on getting a delivery system. He may have missiles from the Ukraine. The Israelis are being very quiet about this, but they're determined to do something. So what I guess I'm saying is I do not see an optimistic scenario with this guy, even though, talking about the Shah and the Persians controlling the Gulf is one possible outcome. I don't see it with this guy in power, and I don't see us in a position of ever getting rid of him.
But our options are so limited. I mean, if we, you were saying earlier that the chiefs are tearing their hair out, and I'd heard this from other people, former four stars, who said that you know, there's no way that you can attack Iran from Iraq because the Shia in Iraq have already said that they will support Iran. So we'll essentially, we have an army, a hornet's nest at our backs. So we don't have any particularly good options. I don't imagine the Israelis have particularly good options either.
They don't have options, and I think the Israelis and this White House would prefer to ignore Iran as we have for the last 30 years, and we've done it fairly successfully, or 25 years. We've done it fairly successfully, but now we can't.
Because the civil war in Iraq.
The civil war in Iraq, you've got the only legitimate political party in Lebanon with any, you know, staying power is Hezbollah. You've got the regime in Syria, which is allied with Hezbollah and Iran, and which controls, you know, the fate of our troops, in a sense, in Iraq. And you see these alignments between the Shia and the Sunni, and we're managing to alienate both of them. I don't see any pretty scenarios in any of this.
So, in other words, the net result of Bush's intervention in the Middle East and in Iraq specifically will be to strengthen, it has already been, to strengthen Shia fundamentalism represented by Ahmadinejad and Sunni fundamentalism represented by Al-Qaeda.
Exactly, and or Hamas among the Palestinians, or Saudi Arabia. So the result of the war in Iraq is we've managed to put in the two most radical factions in the Middle East between the Shia and the Sunni.
And they're probably going to go at it.
They're going to go at it, and they're going to go at us, and we're going to at the very least be collateral in this fight. Hmm. People in the Pentagon and the State Department are saying, well, what happens if we pull out today? You know, the violence we've seen in the last couple of days will pale in comparison. And then the Pentagon's probably looking, what do we do about the Saudi oil fields? What do we do about upcake? Because if there's a genuine war, a regional war that goes down that part of the world, and we lose 12 million barrels a day out of Saudi Arabia and the rest of the Gulf, we are in trouble economically.
Well, Europe's and Asia are going to be hit even worse.
They'll be hit worse because we get maybe 15-16% of our oil from the Gulf, but it doesn't matter because the oil markets will all be affected. And then that's not even mentioned, if you want to get into bad news, Venezuela and Nigeria.
Well, Nigeria's off the market now, and that's a particularly important oil in terms of the mix.
The only way we're going to cope with a crisis across the world in the oil markets or the oil suppliers is completely stop growth in this country and go into a recession so our consumption of oil matches the supply.
Or go green and conserve.
Oh, we absolutely have to go green today.
Yeah.
We should have taken all this money we put into Iraq and started some sort of Manhattan Project of alternative fuels,
right.
Ethanol, whatever they are. That's way beyond my competence.
Right, but $1 trillion, I mean, the Nobel laureate Stiglitz, economist, said that the war will cost us $2 trillion. Well, obviously we're going to be out of the war before those figures come in, but probably at least $1 trillion. So you could have done a lot with $1 trillion. I think that just in closing, Robert Baer, the author of Sleeping with the Devil and See No Evil, both which were the basis of the film Syriana. But just in closing, Robert Baer, you were mentioning the resume of the Iranian radical leader. When you say he's an apocalyptic guy, I guess the equivalent in Christianity, the Left Behind series, the Rapture people, the Christian Zionists who want to create a apocalypse in the Middle East in order that, you know, that their world begins as our world ends in burning flesh. So give me a sense of the Shia equivalent. Is he a follower then of the believer in the hidden imam? Because the tomb that was blown up, isn't that the tomb where the hidden...
Exactly. That's where the 12th imam disappeared down. He's, according to the 12 or Shia, he didn't die, but he's in
abeyance.
Gun to occlusion,
right,
as it's called. And this guy, Ahmadinejad, continues to communicate with him at the Jamkaran Mosque. He drops little notes down a well, which he believes is hooked to this system of caves, which includes Samarra. So you can imagine the effect of blowing up the mosque at Samarra, where the 12th Imam disappeared, has had on him. He thinks we're closer to the apocalypse. And in Bush's words, he's saying, let's bring it on. That's the problem.
Well, on that note, this is about this is about as bad as it's ever been, I think. I'm just astounded that people in this country aren't more aware of this disastrous road that our leadership has taken us on, and they simply do not have a clue how to get out of it. I mean, am I right?
They don't have a clue, and I don't have a clue either. I don't see any clean break with what's going on out there.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Robert Baer.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Robert Baer, whose two books, Sleeping with the Devil, How Washington Sold Our Soul for Saudi Crude, and See No Evil, both of which were the basis of the film Syriana, which is up for a couple of Academy Awards. And, I'm joined by Dr. Khaled Abu El Fadl, who just spoke with us recently here on a background briefing on Life from the Left Coast. He's the author of The Great Theft, Wrestling Islam from the Extremists. And Dr. El Fadl, this book, I understand, has become a bestseller in the Middle East, and many European governments have bought copies of it to train their diplomats. So it appears that you are having some effect where it's needed.
Well, it appears so. Actually, the American government, or at least some branches of the American government, have ordered a substantial number of copies and asked me to come in for training sessions based on this book, but Germany and the German government and in England and in France, there seems to be even a more concerted effort to digest the book. The book has become a big seller, a bestseller, as I understand from the newspapers in Singapore, Malaysia, and Indonesia. And its sales are surprising to me, good in Iran and Turkey, as well as again, surprising, some of the Gulf countries like the United Arab Emirates and Qatar and Kuwait and so on, and all of, Morocco, Tunisia as well.
Well, earlier, Dr. El Fadl, I spoke with Bob Baer, the former CIA fellow that was in running the Iraqi opposition after the first Gulf War, and he wrote a book about Saudi Arabia called Sleeping with the Devil, and another one about, and they've been made into the movie Syriana, and he does speak Arabic and knows the region. And we were talking about the Iranian leader, who by Bob Baer's accounts is a serious radical, and Baer said that Ahmadinejad is a believer in the hidden Imam. And has an apocalyptic view of Islam, and that the bombing of the mosque in Samarra is where the hidden Imam supposedly disappeared from. And so, just for our listeners, can you explain the mythology in Shiism and of this particular branch of Shiism? Why there is this apocalyptic strain, and how significant the bombing of this mosque is? Baer thinks that it's put the Iranian leader on a kind of apocalyptic path, because he's like Bush, saying bring it on, you know.
Yeah, okay. First, it's very important to understand that this is not some fluke of the time theology. For, with all due respect to Shiism, there has been this element, this doctrine in Shiite theology of a hidden imam that will appear or will come out of hiding.
Like the Messiah.
Very much like the idea of the return of the Messiah. The Imam reappears towards the end of time, but there are certain things that need to take place before the Imam reappears. And among these things are acts of real and great destruction and suffering and so on. Now, it's very important to say that lest people think that Shiite theology is just pure evil, that is completely false. Shiism, surprisingly, had actually worked itself through the centuries, through interpretation and reconstruction of their beliefs, to turning the idea of the hidden imam into a very powerful symbol for human agency and autonomy, and a very powerful symbol for activism. They had turned the idea of the hidden imam into the notion that, well, since the imam is hidden, all of us become the agents of the imam in his absence. Now, importantly, it was also worked into Shiite theology that it is sinful to attempt to hasten about or bring about the events that should make the imam reappear. In other words, you can't force the hand of God. You can't rush destiny. Doing so acts basically is a falling in the hands of the devil, rather than a true pietistic behavior. Now, this orientation, which is very well represented by Khomeini, for instance, and that is why between the two, Sunnism and Shiism, we find again a rather surprising truth. Is that Shiism has been remarkably as the underdog, as the minority, remarkably creative. Shiism is the one that has produced in the modern age a substantial works of theological philosophy and or philosophical theology, a very heavy emphasis on rationalism. It is, for instance, it considers one of the main sources of legislation to be reason, rather than the Sunni counterparts who rely on text purity. Now, a critical point is that Iran is clearly moving towards this more rationalistic, more reason-oriented, more humanistic even orientation was in Shiism. They were re-embracing, or they were embracing that school of thought. But I have to say that it is our belligerent political policies that once again polarized people, fed into fanaticism, and brought someone like President Jawad, someone who just 5 years ago, it would have been unthinkable to Khomeini that this would be a serious competitor by any figment of the imagination, that this person can actually garner the type of political support that he managed to achieve was just an absurdity. Iran seemed to be on a very liberal, reform-oriented trajectory. Now, but there has been a massive reaction, and I think a massive reaction to, of course, you know, not just the American, the presence of American forces in Saudi Arabia, you know, literally pointing their guns at Iran, in reaction to the axis of evil, you know, if you brand a people as they're trying to better themselves and reform themselves as evil, 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 evil. Well, you know, they say the heck with it.
Right. Well, there's no question, Dr. Al-Fadl, that our blundering next door, one of the casualties of that, apart from handing the power and most of Iraq and the oil to Iran, at that point, the Iranian opposition, as you point out, had the conservatives on the ropes. The moderates were in control, and then we blundered next door in Iraq. And obviously, nobody in Iran wants to be liberated by the United States if Iraq is the model. And we undercut the opposition and allowed for the rise of this radical. Your book, though, The Great Theft, as you've pointed out, Wrestling Islam from the Extremists, has been published throughout the Islamic world. It's a popular book in Iran itself.
Yes.
Along with Saudi Arabia, the Gulf. Oh, no, you didn't say Saudi Arabia, but
no,
you said...
Saudi Arabia, it's banned, but it's the under-the-table sales
right.
Have been quite pleasantly surprising to me.
And Dr. Al-Fadl, just to finish up, though, on the hidden imam, the 12th imam, and what you told me was fascinating... But just to close the loop, as it were, what is the significance then, given that the Iranian leader has this apocalyptic interpretation of Shiism involving the hidden imam, the return of the Messiah, not unlike the Christian Zionists who want to have Armageddon in order that we should die and they should live? What is the significance, therefore, of the bombing of the tomb from which the hidden imam disappeared? So it would seem to me that is an apocalyptic kind of provocation for somebody who believes in the hidden imam.
I mean, whoever is responsible for this, and I, you know, there are half a dozen candidates that could benefit from this type of aggravation. But sadly, one of the, for this apocalyptic vision, one of the signs that has been foretold in books written hundreds of years ago is the desecration of... the burial site of the hidden imam. So you can imagine you open up a book that was written 100 years ago and it tells you, well, you know, before these great acts of Armageddon are going to take place, the burial site of the hidden imam is going to be desecrated, my lord. The second, it really convinces a whole group of people who were formerly on the border, so to speak, you know, standing
sitting on the fence, yeah,
on the fence, right?
Mm-hmm.
That. This is a time in which reason has been suspended. I mean, Khamenei's whole call is based on there is a place for reason and discourse and understanding. So basically, it tells them, no, we've entered into the irreversible process of Armageddon, and, you know, there's no point in trying to fight it off. So we just got to embrace it. And embracing it is quite frankly disastrous. Now, but I should say that there is a very easy way to, it's historically has always been, of defeating orientations with these types of visions. And that is to disappoint, to frustrate their predictions. To instead of, you know, if you play along in the sense of you fall into the trap by escalating acts of violence and responding with greater and greater degrees of violence, you keep vindicating the theology and increasing it and strengthening it and so on. The most rational response by rational people, rather than ideological people, polemic people, is to de-escalate and to focus on reason. We've got to understand something that I think if we just take a step back and think of it from a rational perspective, we can get a much better handle on it. I am sure there are those in Iran who hope to develop a nuclear weapon, but we've got to understand that from their perspective, you know, the logic of the Cold War, of a balance of terror, and that balance of terror being the best deterrence to actual violence, you know, a lot of them bought into it. We're the ones who invented this logic, and we've shoved it down the throat of so many people in the world for decades. But second is that for people who have who actually believe that it is religiously reprehensible to own or develop weapons of mass destruction, and that orientation does exist in Iran, and they produced plenty of fatwas and discourses about the exact point. To come in and basically say, there are 40-plus countries that have the nuclear technology for peaceful purposes, that there is an international convention that if you sign on to it, you get to develop nuclear technology for peaceful purposes, and the world doesn't preclude you from that. For us to come in and say, as a matter of principle, we will not allow Iran to possess this type of technology, rather than purely focus on the issues of weaponry and do so with greater integrity than we did with Iraq, is a real insult to the national pride of Iranians.
Which is why they've been flocking around their leader, even though he's unpopular.
Excuse me, exactly. That's why exactly he turned from an obscure, marginal figure to a figure now that is seen as, there are a lot of Iranians from the country have this attitude of, we're sorry, we didn't realize that he was right all along. And I think it's a great shame, and it has set us back decades.
But don't you think, Dr. Al-Fadl, that the events in Iraq now, since they're spinning out of control, there's no way that a collapse in Iraq, a civil war, is not going to be spread into a regional one? And it seems to me that anybody that has apocalyptic visions might well feel that it's all happening according to the script. I mean, our president, unfortunately, has basically put us on this collision course, and everything that he's done has actually dug the hole deeper. And I know that you're spending every waking moment trying to avoid a clash of civilizations, to try to bring an understanding about Islam to the West, and particularly to understanding the struggle within Islam, which we seem to be absolutely exacerbating rather than... do you accept that notion that we're the ones that are pouring oil on the fire?
No, I think that's exactly and precisely right. I mean, there is a really a clash of ideologies. We have under the leadership of the neoconservatives and the fanatic Christian right, we've moved from a world that at least attempts to build a consensus around notions of human rights that unite us all, that are objective and that are apply equally for all, at least the moral focus, even though we have consistently failed by applying double standards, but to a very blatant and a very offensive defiance of the idea of an equally balanced approach to human dignity and human rights. We basically have adopted an attitude of we are the ones who know what it's all about. Our actions don't have to mirror our words. If we think we need to move along without due process of law, with extrajudicial killings, with torture, i.e. by violating all the conventions, human rights conventions that we've championed and we've helped establish in this world. If we think that this is necessary, it's our prerogative. Moreover, that prerogative cannot be invoked by anyone else. Why? Because we know better. And there is, of course, a clear, I could say racist, I could say elitist tone of superiority here. And then moving on from there to a remarkable paradigm of might is right. Well, you know, we're not going to sit there and talk forever to try to convince you of the way we see things, the way we define our exceptions, the way when international organizations tell us close down Guantanamo, we basically give them the finger. But yet, if someone is assassinated in Lebanon, we can act like this is the singly most outrageous act in the world, and we are willing to go to war to get a country to comply with that international command. So we've moved from there to a very combative, militaristic attitude of saying, listen, you know, as we've done in Iraq, as you remember the words of President Bush, the international community has failed to live up to its responsibilities, so the United States will. I mean,
well, at the same time, Kofi Annan, the head of the UN, describes the war as an illegal war.
And the Pope in Rome, and you know, every moral leader, Christian Mandela. I mean, you name it. So, but the world presented with this type of you know, draconian option. You either accept our logic, or we'll show you what we're made of. And we're made of a considerable amount of military might. It absolutely exacerbates the...
But just in closing, though, Khalid Abu El Fadl, it has failed. It has backfired. This has not helped the United States. President Bush will go down in history as perhaps the most disastrous president we've ever had. We're poised, as we speak, for the whole region to erupt. So, I mean, that's the ultimate tragedy here, is that not only was President Bush wrong, we are suffering the consequences.
I mean, quite so, but from my perspective, for those who read The Great Theft, they will see that there's a real tragedy of, like it or not, Islam is the second largest religion in the world. It is, despite the Islam haters and the Islamophobes and all that, it's not going to go any way. You can't demonize more than a billion people. It's a vibrantly growing religion. Now, we're going to discover that we have, I fear, too late, that we have, there were several moments where we could have turned the tide into Islam becoming a friend, a contributor to our civilization, something that would have bettered human beings in general.
Well, we can't say that our opportunities have passed. We've got to survive here. So let's just end on that note, Khalid Abu Fadl. There are ways to bridge this gap.
Well, we agree.
And the book
exports it.
And that's the purpose of your book, and I appreciate your contribution here.
My absolute pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I was just speaking with Khalid Abu El Fadl, the author of The Great Theft, Wrestling Islam from the Extremists. As he has just pointed out, this is an important effort to bridge the gap and to stop us continually missing these opportunities to bridge this divide that is growing and being exacerbated. I thank the producer, Lewis Vandenberg, the engineer, Jazz Shepherd, then the associate producer, Rusty Wynn. This program is on ianmasters.org.